This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Damon Wayans first became famous for the characters he did on the sketch comedy show In Living Color, like Homie the Clown, Handyman, and one of the two gay movie critics in Men on Film. He starred in such movies as Mo Money, Blank Man, Major Payne, and Celtic Pride. He's done stand-up comedy throughout his career. His new book, Bootleg, includes some excerpts of his routines. Let's start with a reading from Bootleg.
Mo Money. I found out one of my partners, Larry, is in jail now. He got 25 years for something he didn't do. He didn't run fast enough. I always knew this brother was going to jail because he was one of them dudes that wanted to make it in life, but he wanted to get over. He was a con artist, always had a plan. I called him the street businessman. I saw him when he got out of jail the last time. He's like, "What up, D? Yo, it's good to see you, man. I heard you was out there in California, man. You're doing comedy now, right? You funny? Go ahead, say something funny. Oh, man, you need an audience and whatnot and lights. Yeah. Look, you keep doing it, man. You about to be like the next Bugs Bunny or something. Yeah, but I ain't got time for no Three Stooges-type silliness. I'm trying to get me some income coming in. Word. Yo, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get me a full-time job at McDonald's. Then I'm going to work my way up to manager. Then I'm going to let my boys come rob the place. More money. See, I take that stolen money and I throw it in the bank. I won't touch that. I step off, you know, let interest handle that, you know. And it'll be like, boom, more money. See, I'ma do this like every other day so they don't catch on. Because I don't want to go to McJail or nothing, you know. I'll be in that cell with the Hamburglar. He be bugging me out with that head, you know. Yo, and then clock this. I'ma let my lady forge checks, right? Because she works in the bank. And then I'm going to let her prostitute on the side, you know, just in case the bank thing don't work out, she got something to fall back on. Now, this is only part-time, see, because, yo, I can't have no full-time hoe living in my house. I'm just that type of dude, see. Then dig this, I'm going to adopt me a kid, one of them little foster kids, right, because they pay you to take their ass, right, and I'm going to let him sell joints in school. More money. See, this is good for the kid, too, because it teaches him responsibility, right? Because if he messes my money, I'm going to hurt him. Now, I figure every day before he goes to school, I throw 100 lunch joints up in his lunchbox. Get him one of them Fred Flintstone lunchboxes, you know, because kids, they need that type of thing, you know? And then I send him out the door. Boom, go make that money, son. Now, if he get busted, I come to school, play the father role. Yo, what's up, teacher? No, tell me what happened. I don't want to know your name. I don't want to shake your hand. I just want the facts. Forget that. Forget all that, you know, parental stuff. Now tell me, what was my little white son doing? Then I play all surprised and be like, oh, snap, he was doing what? Ooh, surprise, surprise. And then since this is a teacher, right, I start throwing big words on him. I be like, circumcise me. No, flatulate the information because the whole constipation got my scrotum detached. No. Let me shed my foreskin on the issue. You retain your liquors while I masturbate my embryonic fluids. So this whole thing is supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. See, now when the teachers see how smart I am, they'll probably put me in charge of the PTA. Then I start selling crack to the parents. More money.
That's Damon Wayans, and that's an excerpt of his new book, Bootleg. Damon Wayans, you break me up.
I'm glad.
That is so great. Now, that's really comes out of a sketch that you did on In Living Color. Then there was the Mo Money movie. Tell me how you first came up with the idea of that character and the Mo Money idea.
That was actually a friend of mine named Larry. He's actually no longer with us. But he was actually this guy who always had this master plan, how he was going to make money and, you know, and get over in life. And I found him very funny.
What were his real schemes? Were they what you were saying?
He was selling drugs out his mother's house. And he actually died because they came to kill his mother. And he said, kill me first. And they did.
Gee. How did you know him?
I grew up with him. He was my my buddy. We used to hang out and get into trouble together.
Did your parents worry that you were going to head in this direction if you kept hanging out with that kind of crowd?
All the time. My mother would tell me, you need to be more like Keenan. Because Keenan was like the guy who didn't get in any trouble, ever. He always was a straight-A student, and, you know, the only thing he did was wear kung fu shoes in the winter. You know, that was, that was his only, you know, vice was he was into karate.
You came up with a lot of really great characters for In Living Color. And one of the characters who you did, a prisoner who is barely literate and misuses big words, reminds me of the end of the sketch that you did of Mo Money. Tell me about this prisoner who you came up with and how you came up with the idea.
Actually, there was a guy in my neighborhood named Oswald. He went into jail. I think his name was Timothy when he went in. And when he came out, he was Oswald. And he hooked up with some Muslims. And he didn't really learn everything he was supposed to learn. He taught himself what he should know. And he came out and he was, you know, trying to act like jail was like this great educational institution. And when he came out, he was just throwing big words. And to the guys, you know, where I came from, we thought he was like intelligent.
You know? Great, yeah. Can you do a couple of sentences in the way he would speak?
Well, to defiantly reminisce on the prepossessant prejuxtaposition, which now has differentiated from an extreme clitori type effervescence, would rescinda and certainly defecate a malfunction in the bowelistic involvement of the scrotal, or should I say scrotestical involvement of the millennial or perennial, whichever you may endeavor to proceed.
Did you start hearing this in a lot of other people as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I hear it in a lot of basketball players.
Can I ask you about another character you did on In Living Color that was really great? Anton, the homeless person. Tell me how you came up with that particular person. And I know walking along the street, I would often think of you.
Anton was actually a combination of my Uncle Gene, who was my father's brother, who was on heroin. And we couldn't do heroin on In Living Color, so we made it alcohol.
Why couldn't you do heroin?
I don't know. I guess they didn't want to. It was that whole drug. You know, there was a time, like, when on Saturday Night Live, they could do cocaine, you know, and actually smoke a joint. You can't do that anymore on television. Censors. But he was also a combination of my uncle and this guy who used to date my sister named Anton, who is also dead. he died in jail. But he was this guy. He used to speedball. And the whole character came from him coming over my house and trying to impress my mother. And he looked at her behind and said, "You know, now I see where Dee get her big ass from."
Actually, you have a whole sketch about this guy in your book, Bootleg.
Yeah, yeah. That's where, and I just thought that was the funny. My mother wanted to kill him. And he actually thought that he was paying her a compliment.
What'd your sister think?
She thought that he was like the sexiest thing on earth.
Wow.
She thought Anton was it.
I guess Anton didn't smell like the homeless person, though, who you based
no,
him on.
No, but my Uncle Gene did.
Really?
My Uncle Gene would come by my house, and my mother wouldn't let him in. We lived in the projects, and he would be outside the window screaming up, "Coolness! Throw down the key! I want to come up and steal your TV!" And there was like kids in the neighborhood. I would come home from school and they say, "Yo, we got a bum." And they'd be like throwing rocks and stuff. And I look over and go, "That's my uncle."
How would you feel when you said, "That's my uncle"?
Well, I'd just pick up rocks and start throwing them. You can't, disrupt the flow of the neighborhood.
Right. Were you embarrassed by it or angry at your uncle for being
embarrassed? But I loved him. I had such an affection. I have an affection for characters, people who are who they are in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, that's just amazing. You know, because everybody else is trying to put on a mask and be somebody different. But, you know, a character like Anton or my Uncle Gene, they're just who they are and they don't care.
My guest is comic and actor Damon Wayans. He has a new book called Bootleg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is comic, writer, and actor Damon Wayans. His new book is called Bootleg. Now, you know, in addition to making up a lot of characters, back on the In Living Color era, you also did impressions of real people, such as Louis Farrakhan. And your impression of him was just really great. Describe what characteristics you were picking up on, like how you went about doing your version of Farrakhan.
My version of Farrakhan, I just love his passion. Mm-hmm. You know, in his speeches, and I love the raspiness of his voice. You know, unlike, you know, the Baptist preachers, he doesn't, you know, he's more in control, you know, and he's so passionate, he can actually make black people stop celebrating Christmas if he wanted to, you know, just because he is so, you know, he knows how to give his version of the truth. You know, he's, Christmas is the devil's holiday. It started out back in slavery, where the white slave owner would dress up in a red sheet and climb down the chimney to the slave quarter. And like the devil he was, he wouldn't get burnt. That's why they call him Santa. If you take the N in Santa and put it at the end of Santa, you got Satan Claus. That's what he is.
That's really great. Did you ever hear from Farrakhan?
When I did The Wrath of Khan, I saw his son, and he told me that the minister really liked it.
Well, that must have been a relief, right?
Yeah, I could have ended up in a bean pie somewhere.
Well, is it hard to do somebody like Farrakhan, who's such a controversial figure? And so many people are so passionate about him and might be very, you know, insulted that you were characterizing him.
No, I did it with deep respect. I wasn't making a fool of him.
Right.
I was just, you know, actually showing the power he had on, you know, on the Starship Enterprise and how he was able to make all these minorities see that Captain Kirk was a racist. That was the sketch. So it wasn't really on him. It was actually on Captain Kirk. William Shatner actually wants to fight me.
He's over the hill.
He hasn't found the right heel on his shoe yet to confront me.
In your book, Bootleg, you write about how after the success of In Living Color, it was really odd for you to have a lot of white people coming up to you and adoring you. You just weren't used to that.
Yeah, it's true. And it still makes me a little uncomfortable. But
why does it make you uncomfortable?
Well, I understand that if I don't appeal to black people, I serve no purpose in show business. That's my base, and that's how Hollywood decides whether they're going to make a film with me or not. You know, do I bring in that core black audience?
Mm-hmm.
When you start, you know, having more and more white people, like I go out and I do my comedy tour, it's predominantly white. And for a couple of reasons. One is because they buy the tickets in advance on credit cards. Black people just kind of show up with dollars in their pocket going, hey, what do you mean there ain't no more tickets? But, and then, you know, again, it just comes down to wanting, you know, the insecurity of, am I selling out? You know what I mean? It's a dilemma for most black artists.
Does it make you think about things you should be changing? Or does it make you think about the absurdity of marketing? Or, you know what I mean? What direction does this kind of thinking lead you in?
No, I just have to, you know, embrace it. You know, it's something that you just not used to. I'm waiting for, you know, someone to come up and go, you know what, we like you,
but you're still a nigger.
That's how you always feel.
Do you feel like you've gotten the equivalent of that?
No, it's all love, and that's beautiful.
People really do love you. I mean, you're very funny.
And it's a great feeling to be loved. And the wonderful thing about comedy is it transcends culture and race and all that other stuff. And that's why I love what I do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I have to ask you about another character that you started on In Living Color and then kind of transformed a little bit and made the focus of your movie. And the character in Living Color was called Handyman, and he became Blank Man in the film. As Handyman, he was like a handicapped superhero.
I didn't do Handyman in Blank. Blank Man was a totally different character. I actually should have done Handyman the movie. You know, that was a bad character choice on my part. That's why the movie made about $6. Because I didn't realize how much people liked Handyman, and Handyman would have been a lot more edgy than Blank Man. Blank Man, I played a virgin nerd. He had no handicap. He was just, you know, a geek.
And what about Blank Man? What was the handicapped superhero based on? I mean, Handyman.
Oh, Handyman?
Yeah.
I don't know. I was, in my stand-up, I was talking about how people look down on handicapped people and having a club foot. I understood it, and that, you know, handicapped people need to be loved the same as we do, and that they actually need some role models. And I think it'd be wonderful if they had, you know, like a handicapped superhero named Handyman. And that's how it evolved.
And describe the character.
He's got palsy, but he believes in himself, and when he flies, he lands on top of people. Excuse me.
Now, you had a club foot when you were growing up, so you knew what it was like to have a handicap and probably to be mocked for it.
Oh, yeah. I got all my best fights came from people talking about my shoe. That was my weak spot. And, you know, we used to play this game called The Dozens.
Mm-hmm.
And people really didn't like playing with me because once they talked about my shoe, it was over. You know, we'd start out very friendly, you know, very kind of surface. You know, your mother wears combat boots. Yeah, well, your father is so poor he can't pay attention. Yeah, well, your sister is so ugly she got a top pork chop on her neck so the dog will play with her. Yeah, well, your mother is so black. When she goes to night school, they mark her absent. And then they go for the shoe. Yeah, so what about the crippled people's shoes you be wearing? What about that, huh? Huh? Okay. Oh, so you want to get real now, huh? All righty then. What about when your father left your mother with 6 kids? That's why 2 of your sisters have illegitimate children because there's no one there to guide them. That's why one of your brothers is a junkie, the other one is homosexual. That's why your sister outside prostituting because she can't afford to feed y'all. That's why every time welfare come over, y'all got to hide over my house because you kind of get 2 welfare check when you're supposed to get 1. Your turn.
So what did that shoe look like?
Like the Forrest Gump shoe. Remember Forrest Gump when
uh-huh.
he had that big shoe with the brace that went up to the knee? And it squeaked. That was the worst part of that shoe. The brace would make this noise. And you couldn't hide it. You know, I'm standing there talking to a girl and this shoe go, what's that noise? That's my shoe. It needs some oil.
So how old were you during the years you had to wear it?
My first pair of regular shoes I got when I graduated from high school. Not high school, into high school. From 9th grade into 10th grade.
So this means that during most of your school years, you couldn't wear real shoes, you couldn't run, which is probably pretty important.
I didn't play any sports.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't make orthopedic Nikes.
That's right.
They didn't have the Air Corky when I was growing up.
So did this, like, set you apart from everybody else?
Well, what it did was make me work on my comedy skills, because I would be the guy sitting on the sideline trying to get attention, making people laugh, miss baskets, you know, and you know, that was the commentator. I would, you know, just had this running commentary on everything that was going on.
What about when you started being able to wear real shoes? Did that change your personality?
I actually lost my mind. I got thrown out of 3 different high schools because I was trying to be cool. You couldn't tell me nothing. I turned into Mac Daddy. I'm serious. I didn't even finish the 10th grade.
Wow. That was pretty quick, huh?
Yeah. But my shoes were great. If they graded me on my shoes, I'd have been on the honor roll.
What kind of shoes did you buy when you were able to choose them?
I have a closet full of shoes. I probably have over 100 pair of shoes.
Damon Wayans, he has a new book called Bootleg. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic, actor, and writer Damon Wayans. He has a new book called Bootleg. It includes excerpts of some of his stand-up act and humorous reflections on his childhood and his current family life. Your parents, you have like 10 kids in the family, and what, 5 of them are performers, 4 of them? The kids in your parents' family, I don't know what the others are doing, the ones who haven't been in performance, but it's a pretty darn good track record. Do you think your parents did things that led them to have so many talented kids?
Yeah. What they did was have 10 kids in a 3-bedroom apartment. We had to sleep in, you know, in a bed. I slept with my brothers with their feet in my face, and they would, you know, fart in my face and make me smell it while I was sleeping, and they would beat me up, and, you know, those kind of things make you funny. You become a fighter, you know, and the fact that my parents always encouraged us to get along, you know, to have fun together, because my mother was so afraid for us. My father was very strict, so we couldn't go outside. We didn't hang out with all the other guys. I had a 6 o'clock curfew. You know, even when I went through my, bad stage where I was like actually robbing people, I was tough until about 5:58. Then I had to go home.
Well, what would your parents do to you if you disobeyed them?
My father would beat you like a slave. My father used to make us get undressed and lay across the bed, and he'd beat us with a belt. So you didn't want Daddy mad, because Daddy was like venting. He would come home looking to spank somebody after a hard day's work. All right, who was bad? Because I need to unwind.
Now, in your brother Keenan's movie, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, the mother of the hero that Keenan plays is kind of omniscient, and she's the one who's always coming to the rescue. Did that remind you of your real mother?
Yeah, my mother is just the most amazing woman on the planet. She was so in tune to her children, and she knew how to rescue them, you know, not from anything bad, but from themselves. I remember one time, I think it says in the book, I got suspended from school for feeling up this girl, like the school whore, the town whore. You know, every school has the girl that, you know, is overdeveloped, has breasts, you know, before anyone. And this girl would, you know, let everybody feel her up. And I happened to get caught because my shoe got stuck and I couldn't get away from the principal before he showed up. And so I got suspended, and I had to bring my mother to school. And I didn't tell her what happened because I was so embarrassed. But she's sitting there in the dean's office with the principal, and he's going on and on and telling, you know, my mother how disgusting my behavior was, and making this girl out to be innocent, and, you know, and this kind of behavior is disgusting, and he's like the next Jeffrey Dahmer. And in the middle of this, my mother looks over at me, and I could feel her looking. I thought she was going to hit me. I had my head down, and she said, "Look, don't waste my time with this BS. I can't help it if my son is a lover. And I fell in love with my mother right there. I was like, a lover? It gave me such a sense of confidence. I looked at the teacher like, yeah, don't be wasting her time with this BS. I got loving to do. When I got outside the classroom, she smacked me upside my head and told me, boy, if you ever do that again, I will break you in half. So, you know, she knew right then and there I needed that.
Now, why didn't she respect the principal or the teacher when they were criticizing you? Why did she kind of show them up and then criticize you afterwards?
Well, I think she knew, especially because of my shoe, and if I didn't get, you know, in touch with my sexuality at that moment, you know, who knows what I've been. I was a very introverted kid. I was very mischievous, but I was also, you know, very shy. And, you know, she knew that if I didn't feel a breast and one soon, you know, who knows who what I would have turned into.
Now, you say your shoe got caught and that's what gave you away. What did it get caught on?
It was just making noise as I was running. It would stiffen up. You know, like I said, it squeaked and
I see.
You know, I couldn't like get away in time.
Right. So your shoe betrayed you.
Yeah.
Did the kids in your family perform together? Because you sure did when you became adults.
Just like around the house, it's friendly competition. You know, we call it rewriting each other's joke. So if you have a joke, we'll build on it as a family. And, you know, and then the one who has the better version, actually, it's their joke. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a different points of view on the same premise.
No, why do you think comedy was so valued in your house?
Took your mind off of not eating. Wasn't no dessert. You look in the refrigerator, there was an onion and some bacon grease and bacon soda.
My guest is comic and actor Damon Wayans. He has a new book called Bootleg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic and actor Damon Wayans. He has a new book called Bootleg. Now, your brother Keenan was the first in the family to perform. What impact did it have on you to see your brother on stage?
That was some of the greatest moments of my life, was going out and watching Keenan go on stage at the Improv, because Richard Pryor used to perform there, and you know, Keenan would go up and I would tell him, Keenan, try this, and he would try it and it would get a laugh, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. You can think of something right there and go on stage and people would respond immediately to it, and I was in awe of Keenan.
So did that make you think that you wanted to try it too?
No, I was afraid. I mean, you know, Keenan was the guy who knew kung fu. You know, I was like, I can never do that. I don't have the gi.
Well, he didn't perform in a gi, did he?
No.
I mean, you didn't think you'd have to fight your audience, did you?
No, I just felt Keenan was more disciplined. And Keenan knew what he wanted to be when he was about 7 years old. He wanted to be a comedian. He wanted to be like Richard Pryor. My mother used to call him the skinny man. And he just thought that Richard was like the funniest thing in the world. And he would, you know, if he was on Mike Douglas or Ed Sullivan or, you know, Johnny Carson, Keenan knew every time Richard was on. And he just, that's what he wanted to be.
So how did you start performing?
My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, got tired of me talking about Keenan. And she said, if you keep talking about Keenan, I'm going to go sleep with Keenan. So why don't you go on stage and do what he does, because you're just as funny?
Did you believe that? Not that you would sleep with Keenan, but that you were just as funny.
I think so. You know, I always knew I was funny. I just didn't know if I had the you know, the confidence or whatever it takes to get on stage in front of other people and do it.
What was that first time like?
It was the most bizarre experience in the world. I went on stage, and this is in New York, this place called Good Times, which was on 31st Street and 3rd Avenue. It's closed now, but it was like an open mic night, and I waited for like 6 hours to go on stage, and I wrote out all my jokes on a piece of paper. And I went up on it was the middle of winter, and it was freezing inside the club. Mm-hmm. And I went up on stage, and my first joke that I ever told was, I come from a poor family. We were so poor, my father drove a 1974 big wheel. And I told that joke, and the audience laughed. And then I got so cocky, I folded up the paper, and I put it in my jacket. And then I took my jacket off because I was sweating. I mean, it was freezing in the club, but I was so nervous that I broke out in this sweat. And I threw my jacket across the stage. And then I remembered that my jokes were in my pocket. And I just went blank for about 5 minutes, which felt like 5 hours. But all I remembered when I came off stage was that laugh that I got for the big wheel joke. And I was addicted.
What did you do during those 5 minutes?
I think I talked about, I don't know what. I tried to remember some of the jokes and tried to, that I have like this thing where I never write down my jokes when I go on stage because it always sounds like you're reading. And that's what I did that night. I was trying to memorize what I had written down, and it just sounded like I was, reading a book or something. Without any kind of passion. I was just trying to memorize the joke. So now I believe that if it's funny, you'll remember it. So when I go on stage, it's all kind of improv. And I just take what I like and write it down.
Do you work with notes anymore?
No, never.
Mm-hmm.
It's an insult to the audience. I feel, to go up on stage and look at the paper and go, oh, let's see what else. You're saying, oh, you guinea pigs, let me try this out on you.
You've been married, I think, for, 17 years?
Married 15, together 15 18.
I'd say that's a really long time for show business, in the sense that so many people in show business, once they make it, their relationships break up and they start new ones with celebrity people.
That's very shallow. And the interesting thing about celebrity people, I could never marry an actress. And I could do it because I know in my heart of hearts that she would rather be working than be with me. That her job is more important. I come second to her job, maybe.
Well, is that how you feel in your life, that your job is more important than your family?
At times, yeah. I'd rather be working.
So it's okay for you, but not for her, huh?
Well, I mean, in order to build a family, you can't have two people like that. You know what I mean? And that, for that reason, it doesn't work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic, actor, and writer Damon Wayans. He has a new book called Bootleg. What's happening with your movie career now?
I just did a little independent film, which means I didn't get paid anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Harlem Aria. And I'm trying to get away from studio movies.
Why?
Because what I realize is I haven't been able to do the kinds of movies that I need to do that my audience expects me to do. So I need to go into the independent film world where there's no pressure on me, and I can, do movies like Which Way Is Up, like Richard Pryor did, And that's the kind of stuff people want to see me do. I don't want to have to worry about box office grosses.
What kind of related pressures about box office grosses were put on you when you were making studio pictures?
Well, the studio looks like this. They go, all right, like Major Payne grossed over $100 million. But I didn't get a handshake, a thank you note, or anything, because in their mind, it didn't make a whole lot of money. Do you know what I mean? $100 million total is not a lot of money to them. To me, that's a whole lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So when they start thinking about Damon Wayans for, you know, a $60 million movie, they go, well, he did this movie and he really didn't make the kind of money that we thought it should make. And, you know, they judge me not on my talent, but on how much money the movie made, which really goes back to how well did they market it, you know, and, you know, did they actually exploit it the way they should have.
Do you think it changes the comedy that you do when you're under pressure to make that much money in a movie?
Yeah, because you're trying to appeal to the masses. And the trick is to make them come to you. That's where I want to get to. I want to stop chasing the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to just, you know, my new production company is called FM Films.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know what you're going to be doing with the production company?
Yeah, I'm going to do movies that I want to do. I have my first movie that I wrote is called Envy. It's about this fashion designer who's really good, but he's not gay. And so he has to pretend to be gay because that world is very gay. And he becomes like the toast of the town. And at the end of the movie, he has to come out the closet as straight. And the movie's about, you know, be true to yourself.
Now, is this character going to have any of the characteristics of your character in Men on Film that you did in Living Color with David Alan Greer?
At times, but it's a love story also. He falls in love with his muse. And so he, you know, I think in order to be believable, I need to play him a little less flamboyant.
Uh-huh.
But there'll be moments when, you know, he can be over the top, but for the most part, he's not going to want to be like a queen, a flaming queen around this woman. He's going to try and pull it, you know, tone it down. So it's also an acting piece.
Now, since you brought up the subject, let me ask you about Men on Film, in which you and David Alan Greer played two queens reviewing movies and always just reviewing the films on the basis of how attractive you found the guys in the films. What kind of reaction did you get to Men on Film from gay people?
Gay people loved Men on. In gay bars, you know, across America, they were having Men on Night. And, you know, I walk through the village, I get two snaps up. Even now, you know, it's, you know, groups and organizations, you know, their job is to protect, you know, their people. And so, yeah, unless you come out the closet and say that you're one of them, you know, anything you do is scrutinized. So, you know, I respect the fact that, you know, the, you know, queer nation and, you know, all these different gay lesbian organizations, they got a job to do. But I do everything I do out of love and understanding of the character I'm doing. There's no, you know, my intention is not to offend. My intention is to make people laugh.
Well, Damon Wayans, it's really been fun to talk with you. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. This has been a wonderful, quick hour.
Damon Wayans' new book is called Bootleg. This is Fresh Air.